it's just so much more complex up here. And that was one of my biggest learnings from being on the brand side, was I thought I understood how expensive it was to get onto a shelf. And I was wrong. I was off by a considerable amount. It is way more expensive to get to shelf than I thought, to the point that if you see something being sold on shelf at Loblaws, as an example, for $10, if that brand is making money, they're making it for sub $2 for sure, probably sub $1.50. Like, it's wild what they're making it for, which really makes you stop and think when you see people like the Kraft Heinz is selling things on sale at Walmart for $1, their barbecue sauce. Like, how are you doing that? Right? Yeah. Like, I know, like, I understand
it's a loss leader
and all that, but like, how? Like, this is no way.
This is Evolve CPG's Brands for a Better World podcast, featuring purpose-driven leaders who not only believe in better, but actively pursue it. That's better products, better brands, and better leadership for a better world. Thanks to you, our listeners, this podcast is now ranked in the top 10% of all podcasts globally. Let's not stop there, though. You can help us reach more people by taking a moment to leave us a rating or review, which is critical for podcast algorithms, and by sharing your favorite episodes with your network. The more people we reach, the more good we can bring about in this world. If you work in the industry, you can also join our online community, where we're going further, faster, together at community.evolvecpg.com. I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder and creative director of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow and scale their impact. On this episode, we're speaking with Jared Kligerman, president of The Think Tank, about his experience launching and then closing Wander Nut Butters, the four things he felt he was missing to make it work, how the experience makes him a better advisor, shopper marketing trends he suggests brands pay attention to, and more.
Hi, I'm Jared Kligerman. I'm the president at The Think Tank. We're an omni-channel marketing agency that specializes in incentivizing and engaging consumers to encourage them to try and buy your CPG products, whether that's in-store, online, or beyond.
Wow, you've got that elevator pitch nailed. I like it. I need to work on a better one for myself, but that was nice, succinct, but informative.
Thanks. You know, it's tricky when you're in an omnichannel space, right? You've got to really ratchet it down into exactly what it is you do, because we can do everything within omnichannel, but we obviously have our specialty within shopper. But yeah, I've had a lot of practice refining it for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah. Some people, when I ask them what they do, it's like 30 minutes later, they're still trying to describe it. And then other people just like say something so vague that you're like, well, I don't even know what that means now. So it's for good sure. That you've tightened that. Well, I'm excited to chat a little bit more about what you're doing now, but of course, part of the reason for the conversation was to chat about what you were doing and some of the lessons you learned from that. So you had a nut butter company called Wander. So to start, let's talk about what your inspiration was. Like, why did you feel compelled, or where did the idea come from? And then why did you feel like you had to launch it?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I had the idea, for those who don't know, because it was only out in market for a couple of years, Wander was a globally spiced, but not spicy, peanut butter. So we had three flavors, an Indian, a Thai, and a Moroccan. So each one kind of had this spice profile you'd assume or kind of expect from each one of those countries' cuisines. And it was spiced mildly enough, you just kind of spread it on toast for an elevated PB&J experience, but spicy enough, not spicy as in hot, just enough depth of flavor that you could use as a cooking hack. And that's kind of how I came up with the idea. Was I was cooking in my kitchen, making a Thai sauce. I mean, big air quotes, kind of like what we made in undergrad, like peanut butter, sriracha, soy sauce, maybe a squirt of lime juice if you have some. And as I was making it, I just started thinking about, oh, you know, this is really not Thai. It's just like lemongrass and lime leaf. And it kind of got me down the path of, why don't we have savory peanut butters? We have all these sweet flavors. We got chocolate and caramel and all this, marshmallow. But where's my savory? Because I'm a salty savory dude. Yeah, and so too. I kind of looked at my wife and just said, hey, like, what do you think of this idea? And she goes, I have no idea. You're the researcher, marketer, CPG guy. Go do your research and come back to me. I'm like, oh, that's fair. And so I did some research and saw there's a bit of a gap there. And I found a company down in the US called Elliott's, who unfortunately is also no longer. They just had their last production date in January, just a few months shy of 10 years in existence for them. But got to talk to them. They had a spicy Thai that was fantastic. So I talked to them about how they developed their brand and how they launched. And quickly realized that I had a product that could be viable. And it was a big deal in and of itself to me, because I'm not a product idea guy. I'm the one you bring your product idea to, and I either poke holes in it until it sinks, or we start building up a framework around it and we, you know, get it off the ground. So that was a big reason I launched it. I did recipe development, did a focus group, and that's really what's like, okay, the feedback is very strong. There's definitely a viable product here. Let's go. So one is I had a product. Two, I come from a family of entrepreneurs. And so there's a little bit of, I need the feather in my cap to be part of the family type thing. So that's a big driving one. Yeah. But a huge reason I launched it was at the agency, just due to what we do, my rates in and of themselves aren't astronomically expensive. We're pretty on par for most of the agencies in my size. But where we start to have a real problem in working with smaller brands is the media cost, because you're omnichannel, right? And retail media in particular typically starts in like the five-figure range. So small brands can't really work with me easily. That's changed now. I've actually drastically pivoted to be able to support not everyone. We still can't work with Bootstrap. We can work with a lot more. Yeah. But so I can only work with big brands. The challenge is there's only so many brands that size, and there's a ton of agencies like mine. So I spent all this time talking to small brands, trying to give them advice and build up programs and give them ideas to help them grow their size where they can be like, hey, Jared, we're finally in Sobeys across country. We've been here for a year. We've got, you know, 80K for the huge campaign. Let's go. And what I found in my first like 2.5 years was I had great ideas and people really liked talking to me for the most part, but they'd be like, oh, that's great, but we're not going to do it. And I'd push for to understand why. And budgets were certainly part of the reason, but not the full part, the full explanation. And I'm a big believer that secondhand knowledge and theory only get you so far, especially if you're trying to give really not super tactical advice, because I'll never pretend to be a tactician. That's why I've got a very talented VP who heads up all of our client strategy. But for this is stuff that you should be able to take to the bank and cash in right away. And it wasn't happening. And that really irks me. So if you're not winning with that, you got to get your hands dirty, get in there and do it yourself. And that was a huge reason for why I launched the company, is that I really needed to have that firsthand experience of taking that idea from my head and trying to get it into the majors and get it onto shelves and what that whole journey is like. A, so I could give better advice and guidance. And B, so people, when they looked at my LinkedIn or they saw my outreach, didn't see agency guy who wants to come and take all my budget and money, which was never the case, but certainly what everyone thinks when a president of an agency reaches out to you. To now seeing, founder and agency guy. So at the very least, you'll understand what I'm going through. And it let me go and hang out with the founder community for a couple of years. And it was amazing. And it shifted all my conversations now, because now a lot of founders, particularly in the GTA, because I'm based in Toronto, Greater Toronto Area, most of them know who I am at this point, or know someone who knows me, so they can ask about me like, oh yeah, no, you can talk to him. He's not going to pitch you. He's not going to try and offer his services unless there's actually a fit. And, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, I've worked really hard to try and spin my agency to work with these smaller brands. And reality is I might be able to help you on social if you're not leveraging TikTok heavily, or if you're not like posting 2-3 times a day, because I thought you really need a content house. Like, that's just a huge amount of content. So I do social media for a couple of not-for-profits and certain categories where you don't need that volume. It's just not, it's not the type of consumer you have. But for most brands today in the emerging space, you need high engagement, high content, go, 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 go. Not me. Digital, I can be very competitive, but where we really start to flex now is I have a print partner who I'm very open to share. It's Central Pack. I share it with everyone, because they have MOQs of 50 units, 5-0. That's crazy. What? For print. Wow. Right? For in-store displays, for everything you need for your in-store or your direct-to-consumer company in terms of corrugate and print, they're there at an MOQ of 50, which is crazy. And pricing to match. So now I've been able to adjust my pricing so that if you want to go and do 50 displays, my pricing for the design now is aligned with their pricing on units. I have an audit company through Field Agent, $15 a store. I have a merchandiser, Hive Naturals, who can go and set it all up for you and make sure it looks amazing for relatively cheap. I mean, everything comes with a cost, but compared to what you pay someone like a Mosaic or a Costa to go do that, it's a fraction of the price. So I'm slowly trying to shift us in to be able to support more emerging brands.
Nice.
And it's a big shift for those who know about me too, because for the longest time, I've been the guy who said, oh yeah, no. Don't worry about me pitching you. I can't help you anyways. We're too big, you're too small. That's cool. Yeah. Let's work together to get there. And I'm like, oh, actually, I might be able to help you now. Let's have that conversation. So it's a fun cool. challenge to have now, as I go back to everyone being like, hey, I don't know if I can help you now or not. And the thing is, I'm also not going to knock out an agency who you really like. And almost everyone has a social and digital agency they really like who they're working with. So now it's like, hey, let me come and help you with your retail strategy. And maybe we can help you with a bit of the design work on your print work, but we can just guide you and get the other agencies to do that work. So it's a lot of conversations around how, now that I understand that smaller brand space so much better, I can better tweak what we do with the agency to try and fit more brands. And we're now at the stage where I can do it. And this literally just happened, like, great time for this podcast. This all literally happened in the last 2 weeks. So it's been a very exciting, high intensity 2 weeks of pivoting and adjusting it all. I think we're going to be calling this smaller service the diving board, because we're the think tank. It's your way to dive into us as a nice little entry point.
Or the waiting pool or something, the shallow end.
Yeah, we're trying to play around with that a little bit, trying to figure out exactly what we want to call it. I'm just so excited to get it out there. It's like, we just need to go. We just need more brands to know that we're out here and doing it. And we're able to help them bring all this tier one experience we've got. And we're able to now bring it down to your smaller brands. Say, hey, we can help you, not with everything. We don't definitely won't be your exclusive agency, but we can definitely help you accelerate getting to that next stage just because we have the expertise and exposure that we have.
That's cool. The diving board's fun, but it makes me think of deep end, right? Because you're not diving ever into the shallow end. So, but maybe there's more of a shallow end kind of wading pool or something like that analogy you could play with there.
Something like that. That's great. Yeah.
That's something we've always struggled with as well, is we're fairly positioned to work with a lot of mid to large size brands because they're the ones that have the budget to do professional quality branding, design, package, websites, etc. But I've always wanted to help the small scrappy guys too. So we're always struggling to like basically lose money on every small project we take on just because it's fun and we want to help them out.
That's
but similar to you, I've been saying like someday I'm just going to put the time into developing more of a productized service that we could offer them that is just streamlined but still good. But until I come up with that brilliant idea, that's part of why we do this podcast and online community, is so that we can help more people who maybe don't have access or aren't in the spot right now to work with us professionally through the agency, but could still learn from us and other folks like yourself. Like, we can just put this knowledge and out there and people can like pick and choose which pieces of advice to implement. And then at some point when they need somebody to actually hold their hand and walk them through it, they could call you at that point when they're ready to kind of make a bigger commitment.
That's it. Exactly.
So back to Wander a little bit before we dive deeper into the think tank. Since part of the reason you were doing this was to get firsthand experience, let's talk about some of the early days. Like, I think the brand was out for 2 years. So let's just say year one. What were some of the big wins you got that made you feel like you were onto something and it was starting to pick up?
Yeah, I mean, early days, the big wins. So, I mean, I made a couple of really big blunders in my early days that you'd think, me coming from a marketing agency, having spent several years at the agency as well as my previous job in management consulting, talking to small brands, there'd be mistakes that I'd not make, but best laid plans oft go awry, as they say, and this was certainly the case. So my go-to-market strategy was supposed to start 6 months, 7 months before we launched. And a month and a half before we launched, I went, oh crap, we're launching in a month and a half. I probably should start that. So we had some hiccups out the gate, but that first year was really mostly really positive because we had really good response from the online community. Our direct-to-consumer sales were quite strong through year one. Our retail push was decent. We were getting a lot of yeses, a lot of independents, a lot of smaller, more boutique-y places in particular, but we were getting okay velocity at them. And that was a big thing for us, was I needed to play this slow because I kind of live my life in a certain priority of things. So like, health and family always comes first. She's now four, but my daughter was two at the time, so she took up a lot of time. But I also have an agency. It's my full job. I have seven employees who I'm responsible for. So, you know, that's second tier. And so the Wander was always going to be my tertiary priority. So knowing that and having an idea of what was going to be required to go into the majors, I was slow playing this whole thing. So getting into the number of independents we did, I think we were in five at one point, all within the span of like a month and a half. We got in really quickly. And then I slowed down trying to get into more because I wanted to make sure we had velocities there. So I was putting in more time and effort at those stores to make sure we were getting the turns, and trying to figure out if we weren't getting the turns, why. And towards the end of that first year, we started running into some road bumps. So some of the other independents that was trying to get us into, some of them required you to start working with distributors. And it's real, distributors, brokers, and retailers are all this real double-edged sword where one won't talk to you if you don't have the other across everything. It's like a distributor doesn't want to talk to you if you don't have retailers, but the retailer won't talk to you if you don't have distributors. So it's a lot of taking promises from one to the other. And again, you just need a lot of time. You just need so much time to manage all this. I just didn't have it. So I started to slow down the push for new stores because that was becoming a barrier. A lot of them didn't want to have extra spreads on their shelves. They already had two or three. So I was also coming into the market at a time where you had Nuts to You as a local OG. You had Lovejoy breaking into the market. They were about 18 months ahead of where I was in their journey. Fatso, of course, coming from out west was a big one. Mumgree is a big one. So they just picked up a bunch of facings across the city in Ontario. So I was kind of coming into a category where they'd just done a bunch of shakeup and they weren't super eager to try and add a new one into the mix. My margins to them probably could have been a little bit higher. I was hovering around the 40% mark, which wasn't bad. So, you know, early day was great for those. And then towards the end of the first year, we started seeing shipping rates go up. We went through a couple lockdowns, which hurt some sales here and there and impacted our ability to grow, ran into distributor needs. And it was really difficult locking in a distributor, partly due to margins. And so, you know, we had some wins out the gate. And then a lot of the realities of starting a small business came in really fast, really hard. And again, it's one of those things where I thought I understood and knew what was going to be required and just was taken aback all over the place. So, you know, the amount of capital you need to do anything in this space. I came in with a budget that would be okay in the United States. In Canada, you need like triple to quadruple that amount. Do anything really? Seriously up here. Yeah, the economies are so drastically different. It's just cheaper. There's a lot of factors. One, everything's a lot cheaper in the United States. You have a much higher population in each location. The retail environment is built where you can grow and scale much more organically without requiring huge amounts of CapEx between each stage. So just as an example, there's a peanut butter company down in the US who started for sub $10,000. I think they started with a $10,000 budget, but they had everything up and running for sub $7,000. But they bought a peanut butter grinder essentially. And they had the whole thing. I think they bought it for $700 and fixed it up for a little bit over $1,000. That same machine is several thousand dollars in Canada used. Right? So already you got like a 10 time multiplier on a single piece of equipment. So the peanut price is about, depending on season and some other things, but it's 20 to 30% more up here than it is in the United States. I was shipping in my jars from the United States.
Tariffs or taxes or something like that? Or is just cost of living is more expensive?
Yeah, just transportation costs. So I tried to source everything from Canada as much as I could because at least it was all in Canadian dollar. But a couple of my spices had to be shipped in from the US because there's no Canadian supplier for them. So, you know, that had higher shipping costs, it has exchange rate, which doesn't work in my favor for buying anything in the United States.
Right.
So that was a big factor. The retail environment is so different too. Up here, you've got your biggest independent up here has maybe five stores, all within the same city. There's no provincial player. The second you talk about a provincial player, you're dealing with a national player who's owned by one of the big three. In the United States, you've got mom and pop shops, you got citywide, you got statewide, you got regionals, you got nationals, you got mass. Like, there's just such a more complex ecosystem to grow within. Whereas up here, you've got to beg and plead to get into independence, to get enough traction to have the numbers to take to the big guys who then just annihilate you on their margins and their mandatory trade spend and listing fees. And it's just so much more complex up here. And that was one of my biggest learnings from being on the brand side was I thought I understood how expensive it was to get onto a shelf. And I was wrong. I was off by a considerable amount. It is way more expensive to get to shelf than I thought, to the point that if you see something being sold on shelf at Loblaws, as an example, for $10, if that brand is making money, they're making it for sub $2 for sure, probably sub $1.50. Like, it's wild what they're making it for. Which really makes you stop and think when you see people like the Kraft Heinz is selling things on sale at Walmart for $1, their barbecue sauce. Like, how are you doing that? Right? Yeah. Like, I know, like, I understand
it's a lost
leader and all that, but like, how? Like, there's just no way. So yes, I mean, early day wins kind of disappeared quite quickly as the realities of launching a business came quickly crashing in. And year two was a lot of scrambling. It was a lot of trying to make things flow, trying to find new pathways, trying to negotiate new pricing. And then as we kind of came into the fall last year, I finally got my first price increases from inflation coming through. I went, oh no.
Oh,
and so the first round wasn't too bad. My margins were still okay. And then as I started talking to, you know, I rented a kitchen space. I was making it all myself. I didn't even go to a co-packer. I wanted to control all that experience. So I got my new kitchen rates and they had gone up quite a bit. Not astronomical. They're amazing. My kitchen partners were just fantastic. But their prices went up a little bit. All my ingredient costs went up. Everything went up. My minimum orders went up from the United States by substantial margin. So now I had to just lay out more cash. And so cash flow was going to be an issue. And so by the time we were getting into December, we were kind of all the mindset of like, let's clear out our inventory. And between Christmas and New Year's, when things kind of lull a little bit for everything, let's rerun our numbers and see where we're at. And the margins we had at the start, our own margin was just shy of 40%. It was just nowhere close to enough. Like, really need to be 50, 60% margin to be viable. But close to 40%, I'm like, all right, you know, I can get close enough that it's worth pushing forward. By the end, we were getting close to sub 30. And at sub 30, you can't make that back. There's no way you can possibly find savings at that point, right? So really black and white decision. You know, there's still some emotional hooks for us. Like, our social media sites are still up. Our website's still up. I got to crash those down in the next couple of days. But yeah, really black and white decision, and, you know, cried ourselves to bed afterwards. But that's really what it came down to, was just the margins weren't there anymore. If you don't have margins, there's no point. You know, you can find capital, you can try and carve out more time, but without margin, it's It's not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, you wrote an awesome article kind of breaking a lot of this down about the four things that you felt like went wrong. Margin, like you were just saying, is one of them, which I hear people pounding over and over and over again, as if you don't have those margins, you're going to get the death by a thousand cuts from every, you know, distributor, retailer, broker, like anyone along the supply chain, advertising costs, et cetera, just eating away at your slim margin to the point where you're in the negative on every product you sell. And obviously you can't run a business that way unless you've got tons of venture capital and a really good game plan for switching it to profitable at some point. But even some of the big brands can't figure out how to do that. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there was that news about Oatly losing like $70 million in a year or something like that. And they're a giant brand with, you know, good distribution. So like, how do you do it as a small brand? So one question that popped into my mind is when it comes to pricing your products, I remember when I was starting my business, I took this small business course at a university and they pounded into our heads that you can't compete on price as a small business, right? But if you're trying to go into retail and you're up against five other nut butters who are $3 or $4 or $5 cheaper than your product, then yeah, that's going to be a problem. But I wonder if the nut butter category is particularly difficult because people are used to paying fairly low prices for fairly crappy mainstream nut butter. So when you introduce these higher quality nut butters with better ingredients and flavors and all sorts of other stuff, and especially if you're small business with not buying huge quantities of ingredients and stuff, your costs are going to be high. But do you feel like if you were in a different category, you could have just increased your price to get your margins back up?
Really interesting question. And my answer would be perhaps. There's an upper price limit in every category. And I find that the vast majority of new brands, because most are in the better for you space or are trying to have a slightly more healthy profile compared to the mainstream options, just due to the higher quality of the ingredients, pushes their price point already close to the top of that bracket, especially in the exact situation we're in right now, where price is the number one purchase deciding factor for consumers, just as everyone's budgets are squeezed. Inflation drives up prices everywhere. So in another category, I might have been able to increase it because, to your point, nut butters are really kind of unique categories. I was chatting about this with another nut butter founder who experienced a very similar thing that I did. And it's kind of interesting to your point of we all kind of default and are used to paying that lower price for the cheaper peanut butters, whether that's Kraft up here in Canada or Skippy down in the US or Peter Pan. And what's really interesting is now that we've been through a couple tight periods, and talking to this other founder who's doing this for far longer than I was, she kind of highlighted it, and she's totally correct. When you look at it for a premium peanut butter, it's not its own price bracket with the standard peanut butter here and then like almond butter up here. It's the same as almond butter. You get pumped right up to that same category. And so while it looks like there should be this premium peanut butter category before you go to the premium nuts, there isn't. And so in the same way that if you're buying a specialty almond butter or any specialty nut butter and your dollars in your wallet starts getting squeezed, you don't skip down to like a cooler peanut butter. You go straight down to the cheapest peanut butter you can get, right? There's no in between. It's a hard drop straight down to cheap option. And it was only in talking to this other founder that it kind of clicked for me too. Like, oh, you're totally right. This is a category where there is no middle zone. You're either paying the top dollar or you're paying the bottom dollar. And there's just nothing in the middle. So I do think there are categories where you do have more of that middle wiggle room where if you're priced somewhere in the middle, assuming you can push that price increase through to the retailer, which has been a massive problem for tons of brands as retailers are holding firm on not wanting to accept price increases. But yeah, I might have been able to do it in another category, but definitely not in nut butters. As it was, I was kind of at the top tier of my pricing.
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, these are some of the things that you dive into a product category seeing that there's an opportunity there, but it's impossible to see all the pitfalls you're about to face in that category. And sometimes those issues don't pop up until something like a pandemic or a recession or whatever pops up. And then it very clearly illustrates the issue in that category, right?
Well, for sure.
Whether it's supply chain issue of like, oh crap, we're not going to be able to get this shipped over to us or pricing or whatever. I think that's the value of things like, you know, this podcast or online communities or like Startup CPG, like all these groups that are bubbling up more now since the pandemic to support each other. Because if you can, Like I was just talking to an energy drink brand who's considering maybe shutting down. So I won't mention them right now just in case to give them their privacy. But they were talking about how they would just wish they had talked to a handful of more people who knew the energy drink category before they entered, because they've been in it for a few years and they're struggling trying to figure out if they're even going to be able to survive. And as they've been talking to people with more experience in that category, they were all saying, why'd you go in that category anyway? You're competing against, you know, basically Pepsi and Coke, who have all the money and all the shelf space and everything. So you popping in as this independent person who's probably not even going to, it's going to be hard to even get shelf space, let alone compete on price or anything else, advertising budgets with against like Red Bulls and stuff. I mean, it's a tough category, but that's the tricky thing is like you come up with this brilliant product idea and it seems in your initial studies or maybe even in your local market, you're getting some traction, but then you come up against some of these challenges when you try to scale or when a recession hits. So I don't know if there's a way to completely avoid these hiccups, and I wouldn't even want people to not try to launch new things in new categories, but I think that's part of the pain in the CPG world is every category is kind of a different beast, right? It's not like you can just say, oh, I make food, so I know the food industry. No, like the chips category is different from the energy bar category, is different from the beverage category, is different from the frozen
category.
It's just
totally, it's so wildly different. And I think kind of to what you're just saying, I think more founders need to do more research before they hit play and jump in full tilt. I love the eagerness of founders. Probably the big reason I talk to so many founders in my day is I love their passion and energy and excitement about it all. But kind of like you were just saying with that energy drink company, if they had talked to a few more, not that I think they shouldn't have launched, because just because you're up against the Pepsis and Cokes is not a reason not to go. But it does pay to talk to someone who's been in the space for longer to hear, like, how's your path against them been? What have you tried? What's working? What's not working? And it's those types of conversations that I find a lot of founders are hesitant to have out the gate. They don't want to go and talk to one of their future competitors. But I'm a big believer of what's the worst that's going to happen, right? I mean, I talked to Elliot's, who's unfortunately winding down in the US, but they made a spicy Thai peanut butter. And I was about to launch a Thai peanut butter. And out the gate, I said, hey, man, like, if you don't want to talk to me, all that, if I start poking too many, like asking too many questions that are too close to something proprietary, tell me to get lost. Like, I completely appreciate that. He's like, dude, you're a small little company up in Canada. What the hell do I care about you? I'm down in the Western United States trying to push across here. Like, we're good, man. I'll tell you whatever you need to know. And in the same time, there's a couple of companies up in Canada I reached out to and I'm like, hey, can we talk? And one said yes and one said not a chance. I'm sorry, you're too close to my category. You're too close to me in competition. I can't share anything. And that's cool too. But at least I had some input from people before I launched about, you know, a little bit about my category and what the challenges are and what the big guys are doing. And again, because I run an agency, I've got some access to things like ShelfGram and some other cool platforms where I could go historically to see what the trends have been in that category. And so I came in with some knowledge, but I also did a ton of research to make sure that there's a space and to figure out how I could fight against the Crafts of the world and Skippies of the world. And we looked at things like squeeze packs and different formatting just to stand out, kind of like Revita does with their, speaking of energy drinks, out of Calgary, amazing company, launching a new flavor that I still don't know what the SKU is and driving me crazy not knowing. They did a completely unique package type just to stand, one of the many things they did, just try and stand out. I think it's brilliant. And I looked at that too for peanut butter and didn't. But yeah, it's all that upfront research that you don't want to be stuck in analysis paralysis, but I do think it's worth talking to at least a few people who are doing what you're about to go and do before you launch, just so you have an idea of something you're going to get into. It's knowing it all, you're still going to make the same mistakes, just to be very clear. You're still going to find yourself like, oh yeah, this is the thing they told me to watch out for.
And you'll make mistakes that nobody in the industry has come across yet, right? Because of pandemic
or
supply chain or war in Ukraine or whatever, there's going to be issues that nobody's faced yet, but... So that's one thing I do like about the CPG industry as well. Not everybody's willing to talk and share their notes. A lot of people are, right? So anyone out there listening, thinking about launching something or trying to grow something, reach out to other people. A lot of them are willing to talk and share notes.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing community.
On that note too, though, you mentioned trying a different package form too. So one of our early clients, Yum Butter, was a nut butter company that did actually, one of their first SKUs was a spicy Thai as well. However, when they started scaling, they found that that flavor didn't scale as well because so many people were afraid of it being like hot spicy or something like that. And the Americans are wimps when it comes to spice. So they ended up scaling more of their sweet stuff. And then ended up finding a niche in two ways. One was exactly to your point. They were, I think, the first nut butter in a resealable, flexible pouch, so you could take it camping or whatever without having to carry a heavy jar around, but also have multi-servings instead of just a single serve kind of tear off so you could reseal it. And that got them a lot of traction, like more traction than they maybe would have gotten if they were just in a standard jar or something like that. And then their other unique thing was infusing it with superfoods, which at the time was pretty early, so they were unique in that spot. But even those differentiators, at a certain point, if your price point's that much higher than every other nut butter, like they did some runs in retail for a little while, but they just couldn't stay in a lot of the retail stores because they were just too much more expensive than the cheap nut butters on shelf. So now they're mostly just an e-com brand for people who truly love / believe in nut butter on the go with superfoods. But yeah, there's just so many challenges to each category. It's interesting. And you also talked about how long it's taken to like continually shut the company down. I was just talking with Jordan Buckner of Food Bevy, who had his brand called T-Squares. And I can't remember how long ago he closed, but I want to say like he shut his down maybe 2 years ago or something. And he's told me that just like last week, he finally was able to like finish all the paperwork and officially shut down the entity because it just took so long to wrap everything up on the entity. So much work. So much work.
That's the thing, right? The bigger you get, the longer it takes to wind it all down. I mean, we probably could have shut everything down last month. I think I technically could have. And now, quite honestly, part of the reason we haven't shut it all down is emotional. Like, I don't want to shut down it's like my wife's the one who headed up most of our socials. So I'm like, oh, we have to shut those down. I can just see the pain on her face. Like, oh, it means it's real. And you're finally putting the plug on it. And it was so much fun. And that's the thing, even though we're both not happy with having to shut down, we would love to keep it going. I understand why so many founders end up on Dragon's Den or Shark's Tank with their second or third mortgage and having dumped gazillions of dollars in, because you do get really caught up emotionally in it, right? It's not, I don't like calling it my baby because I think that's a bad way to look at any company, but so many people do. It becomes like a child or part of their family, and it is really important to kind of keep that differentiation between like your decisions have to be black and white. Like, this is not to say you can't have some gut feel on your decisions, but for me, it's always come down to business decision to be made. It's dollars and cents. It's a very black and white decision. Either the numbers support you or they don't. The emotions can come in afterwards. Once you've pulled the plug, you can cry yourself to sleep afterwards, which is kind of how I sold this idea to my wife. Was like, this will be black and white. Yeah. Here's how much. It's like starting amount, second year amount, cash flow crunch, and that's it. If we run out, we're out. Like, we're done. And she's like, all right, cool. We can gamble on that a little bit. But yeah, having now done it, I totally understand and appreciate those people and why it's so hard for them to shut it down. A, because you have emotion, but B, because it takes so long. As you're winding it down, get these little like micro wins as you're winding it down. And some of those are enough. Like, as we were winding down, we had an order come in from someone like, oh, that could be enough. That retailer could lift. I'm like, wait. Yeah, it's going to make money. We still don't have the margin. It's still not profitable. What do we? No. We made the decision. We're done. It's like, no. Right. But it's one of those things where you get that little thing and it hooks you back in.
A little bit of hope.
And there's so many founders I've talked to. Yeah, that's it. So many founders in that post, I talk about having that purpose-driven passion, which is so important for you as a founder, but can also be an anchor if you're not careful, where you just get hooked into the, like, I'm here to save, I'm here for a cause, the world needs this product. And the quick answer is the world probably doesn't need that product. And if you're struggling right now, the world's telling you very clearly they don't need that product. But if, part of it is like, no, I need it, so everyone needs it. That's it, right? It's a challenge for sure. But stay black and white in your decision-making when it comes to finances.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I don't know where this originally came from. Maybe it's like Buddhist philosophy or something like that. But a friend of mine told me at one point this phrase, committed but not attached. And I think that comes into play here too with the business, right? Because you said people will treat their business like their baby, and it's easy to get caught up in that because it is something you brought to life and birthed out into the world and spent a ton of time and money and energy trying to bring up into the world and hope that it'll become a good independent adult someday that you can unplug from and just be proud of like what they're doing out in the world, right? So there's a lot of overlap there to some degree with babies. But to your point, it's also a business that might either close or you might sell, and nobody wants to think about killing their baby or selling their baby, right? So this committed but not attached comes to mind, in that you can still have the level of commitment to making it work and be excited about it and be passionate about it, but not attached to this being permanent. It's okay if your business came out and changed the industry for 2 years and then went away. You know, like that time probably still made a ripple. You learned from it. Your customers got value from it. Maybe you even shifted the way the industry does business for a little while and then let it go. And then maybe move on to the next solution in the kind of problem area that you're trying to solve, which I think comes back to as well. Like you mentioned, again, we've talked about margin. You need to have good margins. You need to have capital to be able to fulfill orders. You need to have the time to personal time to invest in the company, like you're saying. If it's just side hustle, you know, you're going to hit struggles along the way. Eventually, you got to go all in, but also you've got to have enough money to have the time to let it work, to get adopted in the market. Like there's the Manitoba harvests of the world that Mike Fetta talks about. Like it was 10 or 15 years of struggle until finally things clicked and started working out, right? So if you've got that time and emotional stability to keep going through all that and financial stability, great. If not, you got to be honest with that. But where I was going to is you mentioned purpose-driven passion was something that's also critical. And part of that is, like you were mentioning, the energy to keep going, but it also can be a negative thing because you think, well, if I shut this down, then I'm no longer pursuing that purpose. However, if you think of your business as one possible or your product as one possible solution to the problem you're trying to solve, there could be other solutions. So I think that gets back to the committed but not attached. If you're committed to solving the problem but not attached to this one solution, like maybe it doesn't have to be spiced but not spicy nut butters. Maybe it could be some other thing that could also solve the problem that you're trying to solve in the world, but is maybe a more viable business.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm curious. I know part of this for you, the Wander journey was about learning and learning about industry, learning firsthand how you can help clients better by having lived in their shoes and know the decisions they're trying to make. But I would be willing to bet you also learned something about yourself on that journey, because I feel like every big project we take on or big challenge or anything we do in our life that takes a lot of effort and stress and energy and excitement, somewhere along the line, we're revealing part of ourselves too. I know part of what you were talking about before is maybe you learned that health and family are more important than starting a second or third or fourth business. But was there anything else that you found through that journey that you truly learned about yourself?
Yeah, you know, I discovered I actually really enjoy content creation, just not the volume required to do it for my own brand. I had immense fun doing all those TikTok videos and developing recipes and creating the recipe videos. It's so much work, but I really enjoyed doing it until it became a chore. I didn't think I was going to enjoy the content creation as much as I did. So that was cool. I've recognized that having now launched my own business. I mean, I run the think tank too, obviously, but I don't know that I'm racing to go be an entrepreneur again. It's a lot of stress, but I'm really good at managing stress. I've just finished reading Mark LaFleur's book, True Leader, which if you're thinking about starting a company and you haven't done this before, read Mark's book. He spends the entire introduction saying that the book is exclusively for those who have never launched a business before and are thinking about it. He's right. It's 100% for that audience and nobody else. Because if you've launched a business before, you're going to read through and be like, oh yeah, this is all good stuff. But you know it all. Yeah. But one of the big things he puts in there is to be a successful entrepreneur, you're not a founder, you're not a salesperson, you're not a marketer, you're an expert problem solver. And with that comes the mindset of your day is going to be spent putting out fires versus the way most people approach it, which is everything's going to be great. And then you, when a fire comes out, you start panicking. And so in his book, he talks about how, you know, he used to wake up in like the cold sweat. And the first thing you think about is what's going to go wrong. You just feel the cortisol coursing through your veins. And if you're a founder, you know exactly what I'm talking about because you've been there. Yeah. And I definitely had those days too. But as soon as he started talking about how once you shift your mindset away from, oh my God, there's a problem, to I'm a master problem solver. This is what I do. So now it's almost like he says that like his past self would kick him for describing it as exciting and being excited about the problems. But he's right. You do kind of get a little bit more excited about the problems because now you're not, that's not a dread. It's a, I know something's coming. I wonder what it's going to be. And it shifts your mindset. And I've always had that approach without being able to put it into words. So thank you, Mark, for that one. So I know I'm a problem solver. I approach everything looking for solutions, not a, oh my God, we're going to die because of this. But It is a very different level of that when it's your own company, when it's your dollars on the line. It's all up to you whether you make it or break it. And the whole experience has given me a lot more. It's not showing up on this camera, thankfully, but I have a lot more grays than I used to. I really blame the startup because it is a unbelievably stressful thing to do. So I learned about myself. I can handle that stress. I can make it work. But oof, it takes a bit of a physical toll on me and mental toll. And I'm not fully sure I want to jump into that again immediately. So I'm taking a bit of a break from it. But that is a big learning for me. As a guy who always said I want to be an entrepreneur, run my own show, come from the family of entrepreneurs, always want to be at the head of everything, president of the think tank, always been like a senior staff member for most places I've worked. But yeah, it's a whole different thing when everything is on your shoulders and you don't know if you can do it and you can handle it until you do it. And now I've done it. And I'm like, yeah, I can, but I'm not the best at it by any stretch. But that's a big learning. And then not so much about learning about myself, but a great reminder that until you've put on someone else's shoes and done it, your understanding and perception is always going to be biased and sheltered and incomplete because you haven't done it yourself. And it's a really good reminder because every once in a while, if you're in CPG, you forget that not everybody knows terminology like CPG. You go talk to someone in banking, CPG is a completely different meaning to them. So it's like, you know, I get these little reminders of this all the time, but once you go in and you start running a company, like, oh, wow, there's a lot that I took for granted or didn't account for or didn't even think about being a factor. And then once you're in it, like, oh, shoot. So like the amount of respect and admiration I have for everybody in the emerging brand and startup space, especially in food and bev, is already really high even before I launched my own company. And now it's tenfold because now I've been through it. I'm like, holy crap, how you've managed to do it, especially if you're a parent and you've left your full-time job. Like, wow. Just mad respect. This is why I want to help so many of them now. I'm like, okay, now I know this. I know how I can position my agency the right way. I'm still going to tell you if I'm not the right one for you right out the gate. But like now I've tweaked enough things. I'm like, all right, let's see what I can do to help this out. Because, oh, it is such a challenge.
Those are great lessons. And one of them, the kind of talking about whether or not you want to go back into entrepreneurship or not, even though you still really like being a president of a company or leading a company. That made me think of the E-Myth Revisited book where it talks about how people are either a visionary, a manager, or a, all of a sudden I'm spacing on the third one, but it's the person who does the work, an executor kind of role, tactician or something. And I think a lot of people start a business because they're like, well, I like leadership, so I should launch my own business because I like being in charge or leading people or helping them with stuff. Or I should start a business because I'm really good at what I do and I'm better at it than my boss, so I should just go out on my own or something like that. But what they're realizing is that doing the work or managing people is very different from being the one in charge of everything, like you're saying, and having to go solve all the problems. So I think understanding where you are on that spectrum is a good first step before you decide to launch a company, because if you don't have that entrepreneurial drive, there are better ways to do those things that you're good at with a lot less stress and probably make a lot more money, to be honest, than trying to start your own business. So just be honest with yourself of, you know, what your natural instincts are. And if it's not, go out there and create something from scratch and deal with all the problems. If that doesn't really fuel you, then maybe go work for somebody else and take a high-level job that is doing the work that 100% really fires you up or that you're good at.
You can go and talk to tons of different founders right now, especially not so much in the food space. Food space is different because everyone's taking a massive pay cut to do what they want to do in food, for sure. But I mean, I can talk to you about brokers, distributors, the number of social and digital agencies, and I only put them in quotations because they're one person teams, because they used to work for a name that big agency or name that big brand and think they could do it all themselves. And some can't, some are incredible. But there's so many out there who are like, man, I took a massive pay cut to come and do this, and I could be making a lot more back in that big firm. And the ones who are sticking out either because they love what they do, or they've managed to get them stuck in a situation now where they have to keep doing it because they're in that weird in-between spot where they can't quite go back to where they were because it's not quite the right fit anymore. And I'm actually trying to find some of those smaller agencies. If any agencies happen to be listening in that social digital space where they've realized that they got into it, like, oh crap, I just want to do this work. I don't have to deal with like managing employees and payroll and all that. I'm actually looking to expand my agency into that realm by finding those folks. Oh, like, nice. Hey, come join us. Like, yeah, because I need a little bit more depth in those areas just to be able to manage some of the clients we have coming in. But if they don't want to have to be making all the big decisions but still want a seat at the big table, that's kind of what I'm looking for right now. Because there are, in my opinion, a lot of people who actually fit somewhere between the one running the show and doing all the heavy lifting and just doing the work. There's that little spot where you want some accountability, you want some ownership, you want to have a little bit of play at the big table, but you don't actually want to deal with it all the time. And I find there's a lot of founders in that category, and they're the ones who I'm excited to find and talk to, especially if they're agency owners. I'm like, oh, well, that's perfect for me. But in the food space too, because if you're in M&A at all in food, those are the founders where you want them, because when you buy them, they want to stick around with the company for a little while and help grow it some more. And if you talk to people in the M&A space, those are the founders they want. They don't want somebody who came in and want to build up and then get the hell out. Like, no. We need you to come and run this thing. Like, if you're a proper founder, or not even a proper founder, if you like want to run this thing, we want you to stay with us and run it, because we just want to buy your IP and what you're doing, right? We'll take the big stuff and you keep doing it.
No, that's also, I've heard that from multiple kind of leaders, entrepreneurs, managers, whatever, that hiring former entrepreneurs is also just a really great team member to hire, because they know what it's like to do all the things and they know what you as a boss are taking on and how hard it is. And therefore, they're thankful that they don't have to do it all, but also happy to support you because they've been in your shoes. Same kind of like theory to like you going out and starting your own food company, so you know better what it's like to support these other food companies. Hiring people who've been out on their own and done their own thing before, they make really good employees because they know what it's like to run that business, and they're hopefully able to like support you without all this the stress of them having to do it themselves, right? And then that also gives you the ability to put them in higher leadership positions, because they also know what it's like to have to read a P&L or manage a team member or let somebody go, or you know, like all the things that are difficult about running a business.
For sure. I mean, the thing is as well, if you're running a startup, you need people who've experienced the chaos of startup to be able to survive in startup, right? The team at Midday Square talk about this all the time. You know, they have a crazy internal culture. It is a full tilt, no nonsense, go 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 culture, and you've got to be prepared for that. And they admit it very openly. Like, this isn't you, you're not going to be a fit for us. And they're right. And I think that holds true for every startup. You know, you might not be the same go 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 high intensity of Midday, but every startup is chaos inside, because there's way too much work for the number of people. So if you're hoping to go in and just kind of do your 9-to-5 and stay inside your box, it doesn't exist in the startup space. You're always going to be asked to like open up that box and like, yeah, you're sales, but guess what? You're going to come down and work on the manufacturing floor today and help us pack boxes because we need you here. Right? Or like, hey, we need to figure out what the hell we're doing because our supply chain just broke and we're going to call everyone in because we don't know who's going to have the solution stuck in their head. So come, let's go brainstorm that. And if you've been through that before, you come in with that mindset of, okay, let me throw crazy stuff at the wall and see what happens. Whereas if you come from working in a tiny little box and you want to go and try and live in that little box, you're going to get annihilated in the startup world because it's too rigid. You got to be flexible in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that it also reminded me of is theory I have that I think there's lots of great books out there with great advice, or even podcasts, or you know, blogs, whatever. Just advice out there from people who've been there and done it and are telling you how to do it, right? And I've read plenty of those books, and I've found that I read the book, I get the idea in theory, and that's great, and maybe I'll implement it, maybe I won't. But once I personally go through the experience of having to make tough decisions or being stressed out, that cortisol going through your veins of like, oh crap, there's this huge problem. I mean, is this going to tank my company? Do I have to lay this person? You know, whatever. There's these big decisions you have to make that I think trigger a more emotional side of learning. And then once I go through the actual experience and it sinks, it's like literally going through my veins of chemicals going through my veins, sinking that lesson into my brain. That's when the light bulb goes off from those books that I've read, where I say, oh, that's why they say to do it that way, because now I totally get it. I've been there. I've had to pay the price of not taking that advice. So I think part of it too, is that you can go to an MBA, the best MBA school. You can read every book ever written by leaders, but until you've been in their shoes and done the work, it will just be theory to you. You won't know how you're going to react in those situations, and you won't know how it feels to make those tough decisions. And therefore, it's all still just hypothetical in your mind, right? But once you go through that and learn it, I feel like that's when it really sinks in and it makes you a better leader, a better entrepreneur or whatever, because now it's like literally ingrained in your brain.
Totally agree.
So now a little late in the conversation, but it was a fun path getting here. But you've talked a little bit about the think tank, but how'd you end up in this role and how are you helping other brands and companies out there?
Yeah, so I ended up in this role thanks to the wonderful skill of networking and keeping in touch with folks. So I got involved in the agency about 6 years ago when a buddy of mine from my MBA, who I literally met on day one of orientation, you can't tell I'm sitting down. I'm 6'8" and Mike is 6'5", maybe 6'6". So like literally the story of like two tall guys catching eyes over top of everyone's heads literally happened. And he and I had been like, we've become close friends since we met, and we tried to open a couple of other companies together. So he's in banking and finance. That's kind of his specialty. Was I have the marketing and organizational behavior background. Collectively, we're, you know, a pretty good duo. And he knew the founder of the think tank. And so basically bought the agency and brought me over to be a co-owner and to run the show. And part of my condition of doing this was, as a transplant to this industry, I needed real experts to actually be doing this work and developing our strategy and being able to take what I bring in terms of value, which is research and really the research and insights. Because for me, selling an agency strategy is all about staying on top of what's happening in terms of trends, which could be product, consumer, packaging, retail, global trends. I kind of keep an eye on a little bit of everything, so I can reach out to a brand in pasta and talk to them about wheat costs are going to be going through the roof for the next while, because till the war over in Ukraine finishes, and even for the next few years after that, there's going to be a shortage of wheat and pulses and all the other, and seeds in general. So that's going to have a ripple effect into pasta. So if you're an alt pasta, ooh, here's a good opportunity for you to have an extra push because your price comparison is going to be getting a lot closer. So that's kind of what I bring to the table. That's how I got involved, was through the sale of the agency. So I came in, have two incredibly talented VPs, one who heads up our client strategy and oversees all of our clients. So she's been with us for coming up to 20 years, started off as an intern in print production. And yeah, so, you know, I always like to say, if you think what I do in terms of big trends and what I share on LinkedIn is impressive, she does the same thing, but at the granular level, telling you how to spend your dollars and cents. So nice. She's a true expert when it comes down to strategy. So it works well. So, you know, I kind of, not gatekeep, it's the wrong word, but, you know, I'm kind of the in-between. So if you're coming in to talk to us about, you know, what I have a project, is this going to make sense or not? Usually you talk to me first because I'm the most active on the team in terms of biz dev, and you reach out, we have a quick chat. And depending on the size of the brand, I'd say about 50% of the time, I'm able to give them ideas or suggestions that they can do on their own with their existing agencies. And the other 50% of the time, it gets split in half. It's either there's something there for us, or yeah, we're not quite the right fit. Let me find some people I can introduce you to who might be a better option for you. So of the 25% who are like, yeah, you know, there might be something there, they get introduced to my VPs, depending on the size of work. It's Justin on our studio side, oversees all of our creative, name the category industry. He's done something in it at some point in his career. He's kind of been all over the place, which is amazing. So he's got a huge wealth of experience to tap into. And so, you know, we kind of talk to them about whatever they're doing. Typically, we get brought in around specific occasions, like back to school, summer. You know, most of our campaigns run for, if you're in the retail space, a cycle or two. If you're not in the retail space, like I was saying before, the occasion. So you have a new product launch, you need a lift over your hamburger bun, and you want to have a lift in sales because it's the middle of winter. So we'll develop a campaign to help you move those units through a multi-buy with a prize incentive, and we'll source out that prize for you. So, I mean, that's kind of the larger size work we do. We were just pitching on a back-to-school campaign for North America. So, you know, you're talking millions in that budget. On a smaller scale, where we're trying to do more work for startups, it's really... The conversation we start talking about is for American brands or European brands coming into Canada, how do you Canadianize your packaging and your marketing? It's more than just adding you to color. We're very different market, a very different consumer. So we try and adjust those and modify them. And then for Canadian brands, we can help them a little bit breaking into the United States, but we really only play with the national retailers for the most part, or close to nationals, because we do some work with Kroger too, who's not quite national, but pretty close enough anyways. We don't deal with so much the Hy-Vees and the Hebs and Sprouts. You know, we can work with them, but we just don't work with them on a regular, consistent basis where I can confidently say I can get something in there for you tomorrow. Unlike I could do that with Loblaws or Metro, because we're Canadians, we deal a lot more with the Canadian market. So for Canadian brands, we can really help you on digital work, on packaging, branding. And now that we have this print partner who has such a low MOQ and lower costs, once you get into your retailer, you're trying to break into a retailer, POP displays are a great way to do that. And having that secondary location, you know, you can talk to Toro Matcha, who sees like a 300% lift on their velocities. They have some crazy lift on all the stores that have POP displays. You can go talk to Craig at Snack Conscious about how their secondary placements give them 2-3 times lift. You can go talk to Shelby at Chicopee about how their shopper marketing campaign caused them to have 100% growth over the first year of the pandemic in a, you know, in a highly competitive market. So there's a lot of value for going in store. And now that I have a print partner who has, nothing is cheap. So we have to remove that word from our vocabulary in the CPG space, but affordable, comparatively, yeah. Affordable, much better. So, you know, I used to have to quote for POP displays, you'd be looking like 35, 40K as a starting point because you were all on these old print machines. You have to get stuff custom cut. Whereas now you can get those 50 POP displays definitely for sub 10,000 all in, taxes included, assuming you've got your own merchandising team and you can go set them up yourself. You have extra product already made. You can ship in with them. There's a lot of caveats to that number, but it's a big difference from me saying 40 to saying sub 10. That's drastic. And we've adjusted our pricing to be able to support brands in that same size. So for all of those who are looking to break in and have the opportunity to do POP displays, that's a great way to be an introduction to us because we can talk to you about, yeah, we can do the design work. That's quick and easy. But we'll also talk to you about where you're going to try and get the placement, where in store you're trying to get, you know, how to have those conversations. We can't help you with that conversation. We're not your broker. We don't have those relationships with the category managers, but we do this all the time. So we can help talk about that. But also we can talk about, okay, so you have those displays in those stores. How are you supporting that with your social? How are you supporting that with your digital? We can help you with that directly, or we might just give you ideas to go back to your social team or your internal marketing person, more often than not, say, hey, we're going to have all these displays in. Let's make sure that in the next, you know, month, roughly, we are going to have at least one cool post going out on social that is exclusively highlighting that we are now visible in this store. An agency who does a really good job highlighting how to do this is Circle Media down in the United States. Mad respect for Adam. He does incredible, incredible social media work. We can do it too for you up here in Canada. And because we're Canadian, we are a little bit less. But he's incredible. Like, it's that type of work. But we'll talk to you about, like, because we deal with these big campaigns, we always take that omnichannel approach to what we do. But we don't have to do all the work. We can just talk to you about all that extra stuff. So let us piecemeal some stuff out for you. Get some experience working with us, and you know, we can grow together, which is really cool, which I haven't been able to do till like I said, like 2 weeks ago, which is really nice. So we still can't work with everyone, but we are definitely more flexible now around helping you develop different promotional ideas, different ways to engage in store, different print options, you know, ways to just interrupt that consumer journey to make sure that all the efforts that you put in on social and digital, which most emerging brands do themselves internally. It's such a waste to put all that effort in just to lose that shopper because you have nothing in store and your competitor happens to be on sale that day. Or you go, I said a post today about, it's amazing that you have beautiful packaging, but if it looks like everybody else on shelf and you get lost on shelf and I can't find you quickly, no, like I'm a pretty dedicated shopper and I'll hunt down some brands because I know the founder and I'm willing to hunt for it. Most consumers aren't. So if you're not readily visible in some way in that store, it doesn't need to be, you know, a POP display. It doesn't need to be a wobbler or a shelf plate. It can just be your packaging. But if you're not thinking about, you know, what your packaging looks like against the category, or you've already, you know, changing your packaging, your name is expensive to do. So if you're already on shelf and you're realizing, crap, we look like everybody else, what are you going to do? There's ways around that. But if you're now just on shelf and you're not seeing the velocities, there's little tweaks you can do. So we can help you out with all that little tweak to get you to that next stage and stand out, which is getting more and more complicated at shelf.
Yeah. I was going to say, especially for brands who are maybe put in a part of the store that people aren't expecting, right? So Midday Squares is a good example of where if you're thinking, I want a protein bar or a snack bar or a chocolate bar or whatever kind of category they're competing with, you don't typically think you're going to go to the fridge section or the fresh produce section or whatever, but because they don't put a bunch of preservatives and they sell it fresh, like it's in a weird spot. So that's part of why them doing so much social media and being like a media company and active on social media and putting out videos and doing all sorts of campaigns to launch new stores and stuff is so important, because if they didn't do that, people wouldn't even know they were in a new store because they might not ever walk by that aisle where they are, right? So people have to be so pumped up that they're literally going in there searching for Midday and know where to search, because they're not, they in their normal shopping habits might not walk down that aisle or might not even look up on the shelf to see them there, right?
100%. And it's actually an area where a lot of natural brands, where you're listed makes a huge difference for your lift, obviously, but also for where consumers look for you. And it's a big thing. You know, I talk a lot on LinkedIn for frozen brands or refrigerated brands. It's really hard to bring attention to yourself when you're behind a frosty freezer door or a fridge door. So how do you stand out? And it's one of those things. I did a post, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago. Not my work, unfortunately. I wish it was. But a brand called Frilani, they do a frozen garlic bread. And they had a great campaign running where they had shelf blades in the tomato sauce and pasta aisle, as well as over in the beans aisle. So two separate aisles. And what I loved about these campaigns is that at the very bottom, very clean blades, sharp imagery, but at the bottom it says, find us in the freezer section or the bakery. Because they're in the frozen baker bunkers in the bakery. And I thought that was great because I'm going to see that because I'm buying beans for chili or tomato sauce for my pasta, and like garlic bread's an obvious side. And my first instinct would be, I'm not going to go to the freezer to pick up garlic bread. I might go to the bakery, but I'm definitely not going to go to frozen. But by telling me that you're there, I might not even been thinking about it. I'm like, oh, you know what? I do want garlic bread. Oh, and it's frozen, which means I have to throw it in the oven. It'll be done in 15 minutes. So already, just from knowing it's frozen, what it is, and seeing that sign, I as a consumer going, oh, that'd be a great side dish for me. Let me go grab it. Because I have to go to the freezer anyway to go get frozen spinach to mix into my lasagna, right? So it just adds in. So I think I'm a huge fan of cross-aisle communication or partnering up and collabing with brands who aren't in your restricted aisle. Because by helping them promote and splitting that cost, A, more affordable, but B, it helps drive traffic between different aisles, which also helps immensely when trying to sell it into retailers. Because anything you can do to help grow a basket size will immediately be much more probable to be accepted by the retailer, because they're all about either increasing the number of units moved or the basket size. And in this case, you do both.
Yeah, that's the thing. And again, it takes so much knowledge based on individual category, like we've been talking about, and knowing what to do in that category, especially if you're different for that category and retailers might put you in the wrong place or a different place, right? Just that makes it especially difficult. Like a lot of brands want to be the first to market or the most unique, whatever, but they're not thinking about the fact that if you're too unique, then you're going to be in a really strange spot in the retail store. And then you're probably not going to survive unless you get really creative with your shopper marketing kind of stuff. So that's where the think tank can help you out.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just as a fun stat, because, you know, to your point, a lot of these emerging brands who are doing something really different or using something really unique or new. I'm talking to a few brands right now who are coming in from cultures and cuisines that aren't mainstream here. So I hate using the word ethnic or international cuisines, but those brands are coming in. And we talked a lot about education, like how are you going to educate consumers? So for them, it's about how do you use this product. For some of the newer brands here, it's about their sustainability and the green factor, because consumers want to know about this. And so two very interesting stats, one coming out of from Expo, was consumers are turning to their grocers to learn about sustainability more by a couple percent than social media, which is crazy. And second to that, Lydia's from Inmar Intelligence was showing that for seeking out value and menu ideas and the food aspects of experiences, again, consumers are looking to in-store displays as much, a couple percent more than social media, which is mind-boggling. Like if you think about all the trends you're seeing about increasing e-com and all this, those two stats showing that in-store experience is, for argument's sake, say equal, because, you know, a few percent points that could be error, written out in error, but equal shows how important that last mile is in that shopper journey from an education standpoint, from an influence standpoint, from a purchase standpoint. And that's what gets me so pumped up is, you know, of course you need to be on social. And that's what I was kind of saying before. You spend all this time creating all this incredible content on social and driving these people to the store. That last mile, we talk about so much in D2C. But the same thing happens in retail. That last mile is critical. So what are you doing in that last mile to make sure that really primed consumer stays on course and buys that product? And these stats just show, you know, that last mile in store is really powerful. And that's where brands can really, if they have the budgets, especially right now where displays are still way down in volume and frequency compared to pre-pandemic, and in-store communication at large is still below pre-pandemic levels, there's massive opportunities for everybody to have a huge impact on that consumer in that store because there's very little marketing in there right now. So anything that's there is going to have a higher impact than it has historically. So for any brand who is breaking into retail, particularly in Canada, where it's my own backyard, if nothing else, give me a call and let's talk, man. Like, I love to just bounce ideas around and see what you can do. And as I've always said, you know, I'm not one to pitch. If I think I can help, I'll mention it in passing. But that's you're going to have to come back and be like, hey, what can you specifically do for me? For me to say, well, let me quote you. And like, let me summarize. Yeah, a little bit, just because I'm fighting against the image that unfortunately many agencies have, not ours, obviously, but the crappier agencies out there have created of they're going to go after every cent, every dime I have, or they're going to come in and tell me everything I've done in branding and packaging is wrong, and they want me to rebrand the whole thing. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to be that agency. I'm the opposite of that. Like, I might tell you that I think a rebrand is worthwhile, but only once you ask me, like, what do you think of my branding? And if you were me, what would you change? I'll tell you. I'll be like, yeah, maybe you should change it. But if you love your packaging, I'll tell you my 2 cents, but I'm not going to also in the same breath be like, yeah, you know, it can be better. You should absolutely do this right now. Otherwise, I'm not going to work with you. I'll be like, oh, you know what? I've noticed some trends around your packaging you might want to look at as a future consideration. This, this, and this. But on the short term, we're looking at moving more units in the next for back to school. The packaging we can talk about later. Let's focus on back to school. And then from there, it's, okay, what are your budgets? What's your core objectives? Have you thought about this at all? Do you need partners? And we kind of take it from there. It's a discussion. And if it makes sense for us to get involved and make it all work, amazing. And if not, I'll tell you right up front, like, yeah, no, you should definitely do all this. But instead of using me to do all this, maybe you should use Aisle for your couponing and go direct to them because they can help you out with that. Or go straight to Central Pack and get them to do all your printing because that's cheaper than bringing me into the equation. But once that runs and that's worked well, you're going to need to scale that up. And when you need to scale it up, now you need to have it all be cohesive. Either use me to help with the cohesion from the get-go, or once you're like, ah, okay, these tactics all work, but we're running them independently. They need to be as a cohesive strategy to be omnichannel. Come back to me, be like, okay, we know these things work. Develop a strategy and a big idea that's going to tie all this together, stay true to our brand, and make this help us roll it out. Aha, that's where we can really flex and do some incredible work. But we have to get you there and make sure that it makes sense for everybody that you go so big and that you have the right resources in place and that you have the inventory available. And as we were saying before, there's so many moving pieces you've got to consider on these things that I want to make sure that we're setting everyone up for success. So don't worry about me coming and pitching you. It's not going to happen. Let's have a cool conversation and never know what's going to happen. Yeah, it might be with me, it might not, but let's have that combo.
Yeah, totally. I think there's so many agencies out there that are either obsessed with trying to scale and therefore have to go out and try to get as much work and as big of work and whatever as they possibly can and are going to try to convince you to do everything with them or something like that and everything right now. Or they're already so big that they've got a ton of people on payroll that they need to keep on payroll. So they're going to go after as much work as possible. Whereas that's kind of why I've intentionally stayed small because we're focused on the impact our clients are making and us just helping them get there is our goal. So for me, it's less about how much money can I extract from a client as it is about, well, how much can we get done with as little money as possible so they can put more money to staying in business and putting money towards impact. I would rather them have money left over to get that certification or to make that donation to some charity or whatever than me driving around in fancy sports cars that I don't need, right? So I think that's the difference. There's agencies out there that need all the money, and there's agencies out there that are doing it to help you do whatever you want to do with your business. And therefore, people like you and I are more than happy to hop on a call and give you all the advice we possibly can, whether or not you work with us. Whereas some agencies are just going to get you on a call and try to get you to sign a contract by the time you're off the call for 10 times more.
Oh, for sure. It's a difference between looking at, I want this project right now and I'm going to squeeze every penny out of it versus I don't want a one-time project. I want to work with you for the next like 3 to 5 years. And if that means having to start super small and do, you know, 2 small, tiny social media campaigns for you or build out a bunch of creative for you this year, cool. Next year, I'll be build out all the creative and we'll do a little bit of digital work and we'll find some cool digital screens to get you on, whether they're billboards or elevators or wherever. We'll do a little bit extra. And then the next year, we've finally got your size, but now you're doing in-store work. And I was like, great. So like, yeah, I'm all about looking at that long-term relationship and saying, well, how do we get the most value for everybody out of this, which is think long-term, not on the immediate, you know, dollars and cents. How much can I possibly make off this? No. As long as my costs are covered, I'm willing to work with you to make this viable for both of us, right? It's a much better way to do business, I think.
Totally. I love it. I've already kept you way too long, but I'd be remiss without asking if there's any other trends that you are seeing in the market right now that you think brands should jump on. You already mentioned kind of that last mile kind of idea of people are going to their retail stores or their grocer to learn about sustainability or other things. So definitely don't ignore the retail environment when it comes to brand storytelling or impact storytelling. Is there anything else you feel like that's top of your mind right now that you feel like every brand should be jumping in on?
That's a really good one. I think there's a lot of discussions around claims, whether that's should I get kosher and certifications, like should I get kosher certified, should I get organic, should I get Whole30, should I get non-GMO, and what's important to consumers changes quite a bit and a lot more frequently than a lot of brands think, I think. And I was just having a coffee this morning where we were talking about this, which is why it's so top of mind. Because we were talking about some of the claims they went through, and they decided, partly from a cost standpoint, to not get certified organic. They're non-GMO, but not organic. And I said, oh, I bet you your consumers don't care about that, do they? He said, not a bit. But we thought they did. We went and did it. We had to go do research to prove to the CMO that this claim isn't important enough for us to spend the premium dollar that will cost our price up by $2. It's just not worth it. And so I think that's a really big discussion right now, as so many brands are struggling to meet their current expenses, are looking to try and figure out how to modify what they're doing or how to add to what they're doing to get more consumers and to gain new market share. You know, everyone I'm talking to is looking at new SKUs, new flavors, new categories to expand into. And I think as they do that, one of the things they also should be testing as they go along, seeing where the opportunities are, is what claims are going to be important, because getting certified is expensive. I'm Jewish, so I can say this somewhat confidently. Kosher is something, it's a very expensive certification to get. And quite frankly, it only serves you a very small percentage of the population who cares. Now, they do over-index and tending to be a little bit wealthier, having a little bit more disposable income. But unless you're really targeting them as one of your major buyers, kosher is a super expensive cert. And I personally think there's probably other ones that are going to be more important to your target demographic, who religion for most products isn't a major factor. And dietary of that nature isn't a major factor. Unless you're really targeting the practicing Jewish community with your product, they're relatively small in terms of the total population. In the same way that if you're a plant-based product, are you really targeting vegans, or are you targeting healthier mindset flexitarians? And that's a very big difference on how you position, how you market. And I will tell you, the vegan community is, I think, the vegetarian and vegan communities combined, I still don't think make up 10% of the total population, and vegan is the smaller of the two. I think they're at like 3%, and I think vegetarians are like 5 or 6, something like that. Don't quote me on these numbers. I haven't looked them up super recently. So if you're plant-based, who are you targeting? Is it the vegans? Because if it's vegans, that's a whole separate animal. It's a completely different strategy in how you target them. It's a different growth plan versus you're targeting flexitarians. And so, you know, there's been a lot of discussions around that recently. I've happened to have a bit of an eye on the halal market myself recently, because I see a lot of opportunity there, just due to the shifting demographics of our country. And I see a lot of opportunity there. So yeah, I think a trend for everyone in, especially the natural space, as a lot of repackaging going on and rebranding going on, and hello, give me a call, happy to help you. But also as you do that, check the claims, like check whatever you only have so much space on the front of your pack, and you don't want it to look super messy. Like, you can have every claim under the sun, but only one or two are really going to be important to your consumer in making that purchase decision. Everything else is a nice to have. So check with your consumers, send a survey out to your top buyers and see what they care about. When you're doing your package design, if you've got the funds available, engage someone who can do eye tracking. So Rich Moran is one of the Canadian guys I know who does it. But see what people look at when they look at your packaging. Are they seeing the right things? Maybe they're not seeing the right attributes. Maybe the design's wrong, right? And claims being a big one. Is that claim going to make a difference? I was just chatting with Rich about this, and he's like, yeah, on some products, that claim is the second thing they see after the brand. On other products, they want flavor. Flavor is more important than whatever the health claim is. So you have to understand that. And so I think it's worth right now, especially if you're a semi-established brand who's about to do a massive rebrand and refresh, spend that little bit of extra time to really hone in on what the key claims and key drivers are of your existing consumers, but also that target audience you're trying to get you don't currently have. Because it may have changed since you launched in the last 2-3 years. certainly has in the bone broth space. It used to be organic was a huge deal. That's, I think it's more grass-fed. It's been a little while, even that might have changed, because I haven't talked to Tim Aprioia, who was talking to me about that, because he went through that change. That might have changed. He changed all his packaging to get rid of organic and put grass-fed as a top plant, right? So I think that's a big one. Check in, see what's going on. Make sure you're still hitting the right notes with your consumers, because if you're not, your competitor sure as hell will.
Yeah, that's a great note. And I would say not just consumers, but your retailers too, because if you're really desperately trying to get into a specific retailer, like you were mentioning, talk to them as well, because some retailers won't even let you in the door if you don't have XYZ certification. Some don't give a shit. Absolutely. So it's like, just figure out what's actually needed. So again, that you can put the money where it matters rather than burning it on the do good tax of having to have every certification and jump through all those hoops and pay all those fees. Because, you know, I'm a big believer in the impact, but I also am frustrated by the fact that Better for the World brands are the ones having to pay for all these taxes when we already have the tighter margins, right?
For sure. And it's a huge expense to like take your product that isn't organic and turn it organic. And so before you go and spend the cash or fair trade or whatever the claim is going to be, because I've seen people drop out of fair trade and go organic and vice versa on different products and different categories because that's where consumers' trends have gone. And I've seen people make the wrong decision and go pick the wrong one, invest huge amounts of cash, and it pumps their dollar price up, and now all of a sudden their sales drop. And you're like, damn it, you know, I thought this is what my consumers want. And that is the biggest risk ever. When you think something, don't think it or assume it. Go and check it. Get some hard stats before you go full tilt on this, which, you know, it's in the moment, it's exciting and you're eager and you think you know what everyone wants, but check that. Like, I do it all the time and it's shocking how often I'm wrong. I actually just posted it up a while back, but I did a whole one looking at the shelf because to see what packages stand out against the category. And I thought for sure in the tomato sauce category is going to be the bright pink and the bright green and the bright purple. No. It's a bright red. The bright red is what caught the eye. Would never guess that. Not a million years, but it's because I'm guessing here, this is a little bit of an intuition. When you go shop pasta sauces, you're all looking for red, and having a very bright, different shade of red catches your eye more than the random color you're not expecting to be there. And that's what heat tracking and eye mapping showed, which blew my mind, but it was not at all what I was expecting. But that's why you have to go check these things, right? I think I know what I'm talking about. Even I was proven wrong by data, right? It's why I love research.
Yeah. Always check the numbers, I guess.
Yeah. Always check the numbers.
Great tips. So thanks for staying on a little longer and geeking out on some of this stuff with me, going deep on some of these areas. I appreciate you sharing all that wisdom, and it's fun to pick apart your journey with Wander as well as your experience with the Think Tank. So thanks for coming on and sharing some of your wisdom and knowledge with the community. And thanks for all your content on LinkedIn for everyone listening right now. Definitely follow Jared on LinkedIn, posting articles about his journey with Wander, but a lot of other insights as well. So thanks for everything that you're doing out there, and thanks for taking the time to come share that.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Jared or his agency, visit TTTMRKTG.com. That stands for The Think Tank Marketing.com. Again, that's TTTMRKTG.com. Subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel for more innovator interviews, expert advice, and leadership discussions. If you like this episode, leave a heart, thumbs up, or review, and share it with your colleagues. As an ever-evolving show, we also love feedback, so send us ideas for who we should talk to next to evolve@modernspecies.com. And of course, if you work in the industry, come join our community at community.evolvecpg.com, and we'll go further, faster together.